Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about. Greetings from the New Deal Ideas Summit in Phoenix, Arizona. This is an annual event where New Deal leaders gather to exchange policy ideas with each other and leading experts in the field. During this summit, I pulled a couple leaders aside for an in-person podcast. This is the first of those conversations. Ben Bowman is the newly selected majority leader of the Oregon State Legislature. We're both proud alums of the University of Oregon and the student government there. He's an incredibly thoughtful leader who got his start in the tumultuous world of COVID-era school board politics before quickly rising in state government. He shared how he's not shying away from addressing the tough issues in his state: housing, homelessness, and crime. He's young, but you can see why his peers selected him to help lead their caucus. Enjoy. Oregon Majority Leader Ben Bowman, welcome to An Honorable Profession.
Thank you so much for having me. Excited to be on the pod.
You just finished the short session of the Oregon Legislature. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some highlights in addition to you being selected as Majority Leader?
Yeah. So it's considered by many to be the most productive short session that Oregon's ever had. We moved to annual sessions in 2015. Our even-numbered year sessions, the one we just got done with, they're capped at 35 days. So they're very short. Wow. The timelines fly by. And then our long sessions in odd-numbered years are about 5 or 6 months. So you take the entire timeline of first chamber deadline, second chamber deadline, all and crunch down to 32 days. And in the session, we passed a major housing package that the governor, Governor Tina Kotek, took the lead on. We passed for the first time in decades campaign finance reform in Oregon. We're a state right now where there's no contribution limits. You could give me a check for $1 million to my PAC right now, and I would accept it. But we changed that and are going to get money out of our politics in Oregon. And then probably the most attention was spent on our addiction crisis. Folks often know about Measure 110. It was the ballot measure that passed in Oregon. We've had a big problem with addiction for many years. So we made some tweaks and made significant new investments in treatment in Oregon, all in 32 days.
I feel like there's a fascinating political science study that could be done about the efficacy of forcing short deadlines and whether that concentrates the mind. Let's talk about each one of those things. So let's talk about how did the housing reforms go? What were the key issues, and what do you think the change will be?
So on all three of those issues, somewhat remarkably, I will say, they were passed with broad bipartisan majorities. So most Democrats and most Republicans voted for all three of those things. This coming on the heels of our last long session, where Republicans in the Senate walked out of the legislature and essentially shut down the legislature for months. So to go from that to this was a really welcome change. In terms of the housing package,
do you think that had more to do with the issues or with a sense that we're elected, we should get something done?
I think it had more to do with the issues, to be honest. The walkout in the last legislative session was primarily about a bill protecting reproductive freedom for women and protecting trans youth. So highly volatile issues on the Republican side, lots of feelings. There was also, in a long session, we had bills about gun safety and other things that were higher temperature. So I think the intention going into the short session, there's just no room for walkouts or any kind of spectacles like that. So you have to focus on a small set of issues. And so those three were the ones that were identified as the most important ones. So housing package, to make a very long story short, Oregon was the first in the country to pass a land use planning system. I think some states still don't have a land use planning system. It's pretty much a free-for-all. So in Oregon, growth is tightly managed. And there's a series of levers and decision-making bodies who have to sort of approve of growth beyond what we call an urban growth boundary. This bill makes a series of investments. First, it makes big investments in infrastructure. So water and sewer lines. Like some of these, the nuts and bolts of building houses are big barriers to actually getting in Absolutely. The game. We've created conditions in which the urban growth boundary, that sort of boundary around which growth can occur, we made it a little bit easier to grow the urban growth boundary, but only under certain conditions and only when, A, there's like a demonstration of needed housing, and when the housing that will be built will have a certain percentage that's affordable housing. So there's a few provisions like that, but I think the most important part was the investments, hundreds of millions of dollars of investments that we made in actually constructing new housing.
And I know that's a big issue in the Portland area, mm-hmm. is trying to make sure that it's the housing aligns with transit, aligns with the other services. What are you seeing in the Oregon housing market in terms of affordability and people's ability to access quality housing?
It's really tough. It's very tough right now. Costs have gone up tremendously in the last 10 years. And, you know, a lot of folks know we have a very serious homelessness population in our state. And I think part of the challenge there is we have this addiction crisis in Oregon, but there's a lot of states that are navigating an addiction crisis. But in our state, there really is not very much affordable housing, especially compared to states in like the Midwest. So those two challenges, I think, play off each other, yeah. where you can't afford a place to live and you've got that you're struggling with this addiction and we didn't have the capacity or the facilities to actually treat you. So it created this sort of mix of crises that are really deeply impacting Portland, but also the rest of the state too. This isn't just a Portland problem, which is what I think made it a little easier to deal with. Folks, Republicans in rural parts of the state are seeing homelessness in their towns. They're seeing unaffordable housing. And so I think that helped pave the way for a bipartisan solution.
Let's talk about the addiction crisis. Obviously, mm-hmm. in coastal California, yep. I face the exact same issues.
Yep.
And Oregon had a statewide reform through an initiative, mm-hmm. decriminalized a lot of drugs. The legislature's now rolled back part of that. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the strategy and what you hope the outcome will be?
This was the toughest issue, the short session, I'll say, the most attention and the most disparate views. We heard from a lot of folks who are strongly against where we landed, and we heard from folks who are strongly supportive of it. Here's how I would describe where we landed. We created a system where treatment first is the standard approach. I still believe, have the most progressive laws in the country, but we also have included the law enforcement system as a sort of stopgap, as a backstop measure. In the current system, after Measure 110 was passed, drugs were decriminalized and law enforcement essentially were saying we have no ability to intervene, including when there was open use of drugs. We were hearing from law enforcement saying they didn't believe they had the ability to intervene. We had open air drug markets that were well publicized. So the decision was made to make possession of small amounts of drugs an unclassified misdemeanor that would essentially give law enforcement the tools to intervene. That being said, when a person enters or interacts with law enforcement, what we create is we call it deflection. Have you heard of this? Do you have a deflection system?
We do not, although I think California is looking at the Oregon model now as a potential reform because we're seeing the same intersection of homelessness, addiction, yep. low-level crime, and just a general frustration that we feel like we're allowing people to subsist and exist in misery and mm-hmm. not really helping them in any way.
So the system is sort of built on the belief that jail is probably not the best place for someone struggling with addiction to be. That's also the foundation of Measure 110, but that measure basically said there's no role whatsoever for the criminal justice system. But there are some people, some of whom we heard from, who actually were able to get clean because of their entrance into the criminal justice system. So like what I always remind folks, I mean, this is something that impacts my family. My older brother has struggled with drug addiction. He's been in and out of homelessness in Portland. And like the times where he has been sober in the last 10 years were when it was court ordered as part of a treatment program or when he was incarcerated. That's not the right approach for everyone. And frankly, it didn't stick with him either. So I'm not saying it's like the magic solution. I just think every person is different. Every person's crisis is different and every person's needs are different. So I think what we've tried to build here is a system that attends to those differences. So how does it work? I mentioned deflection. People are probably familiar with diversion. You get arrested, you go to court and the judge says you can do this instead of go to jail and you'll avoid a sentence. Deflection is like diversion, but earlier in the process. So a law enforcement officer encounters you on the street and you possess drugs. instead of arresting you and taking you to jail, you immediately in that moment have a choice. If you want to go seek treatment, we will do that. We will make that available to you. It won't go on your record. It won't be held against you. If you refuse, if you choose not to, then ultimately you may go through the criminal justice system. But at every interval in the criminal justice system, you will continue to be given a choice. Do you want to receive treatment? So that's what I really like about the system, because I do think that getting folks into treatment is the best and most important first step. The broader problem that we face, and I'm sure you guys are facing too in California, although I understand you all just passed a big ballot measure that's going to reallocate a bunch of money that I'm interested in. We don't have the workforce. We don't have the facilities. We don't have the infrastructure to provide treatment to the number of people who need treatment. So that was a big part of the bill, was just investing a lot of money, which is building on big investments over the last two bienniums to expand the places where these folks can go to access treatment. But those are going to take years to come into effect. So it's not going to get solved overnight.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's the message for everyone, is we can approach all these things. It's a big, hard problem.
That's right.
As you say, that's overlapping with a lot of other issues. And so it's really challenging.
Give me the summary of the California ballot measure, the Gavin Newsom measure.
The Gavin Newsom measure. So what the most recent measure was that was passed in March by the voters. For like 20 years, we've had a Mental Health Services Act, which is a tax on multimillionaires, an additional percent. It went to mental health services. Governor Newsom proposed taking a percentage of that, and 20% of that existing funding, and bonding it to create about 11,000 beds. Wow. That will range from like locked treatment facilities for both mental health and substance abuse to like transitional housing for people transitioning out of jails or these facilities or other things. And so it's going to take time. And the hard part is coming from existing resources. So it will mean cuts to the other parts of the mental health system, and because it's not new money. But what the overall feeling was, and that I agreed with, was that the Mental Health Services Act, we had sort of given up on the toughest to reach people, the most people who were most service resistant. We were helping a lot of people upstream, and that's great, and a lot of hotlines and help. But like, the folks that you see really struggling, there was no system for them and no resources for them. And so, and especially when they refuse service. And so that's what this seeks to address. And then the statewide, the district attorneys are proposing a sort of a rollback, a changing of the California's measure, which moved a lot of felonies to misdemeanors and decriminalized a lot of misdemeanors. And with, again, a focus, just like you said, which is if you're being constantly rearrested, you have to be offered treatment or jail, but that we need to create a treatment system for people to be able to be offered all the way through the system.
Well, I hope it works. I hope it works for y'all. I hope it works for us.
Yeah. I mean, I think Oregon's a little bit ahead, so we'll see. We should see some results up there first. So let's talk campaign finance reform and what that looks like.
So Oregon is considered the Wild West of campaign finance, as I mentioned, unlimited contributions. But the trade-off in Oregon was that you always had pretty solid transparency. So within 30 days of you giving me a contribution, it has to be reported your name, your occupation, where you work, all that stuff. And as you get closer to the election, the reporting is 7 days out. So really good transparency, but unlimited giving. We passed a bill in the short session, again, bipartisan, and frankly, not just bipartisan Democrats and Republicans, but like business and labor and some of the big folks who are big political givers were also engaged in the conversation. I think feel like we arrived at a balanced place. You know, without going into too many of the details, like there's this big rubric that where there's like 18 different columns and 15 different rows that say who can give how much in which situation. But in general, we have capped donations from various individuals, organizations, party committees, candidate committees, et cetera, at certain amounts. We've maintained the transparency piece. What I will just flag, because I know this is an audience of pretty engaged political listeners, what I am worried about is that we are going to force more money to be spent via IEs, independent expenditures, where there's tends to be less accountability, tends to be less transparency. So that's something I'm going to be watching. I do think this is the right move and a positive change. The amount of money flowing into our elections is ridiculous. We really have had like individual billionaires give, $4, $5, $6, $10 million in a cycle or two. So we have to make the change, but I am doubtful that money will just disappear from politics because of campaign finance reform. I don't think that's what's going
to
happen.
Yeah, as they say, it's like putting your finger on the end of the hose. The water tends to just squirt out in different directions.
That's right. That's right.
Let's talk a little bit about how you found yourself engaging on this wide array of issues. And, yeah. and I'm sure in the longer session, there'll be even thousands of more issues.
Yep.
You came through student government and school board politics, which is by far the most difficult politics to navigate any given time, but especially during COVID. Can you talk about how you came to public service?
Yeah. So I interned in the state legislature when I was a student at the University of Oregon. Go Ducks.
Go Ducks. Absolutely.
Both Ducks and both Oregon Student Association alumni. So that was a great training course for me. Before I got to U of O, I interned on a gubernatorial campaign for Governor John Kitzhaber in his third campaign, his record-breaking third campaign for governor.
I worked on his first campaign.
Oh, did you really?
So it goes to show the generational divide here.
Yeah, that's awesome. So I started getting involved in campaigns and elections, started getting involved in the legislature. And then when I graduated, I worked as the sort of LA2, we call it, the junior legislative assistant in an office for my local state rep at the time, Representative Margaret Doherty, who now is my neighbor in Tigard.
Nice.
And then I moved in to be the district legislative aide for the majority leader at the time, Val Hoyle, now a member of Congress.
Absolutely. And a New Dealer.
And I believe a New Deal leader. Yeah, that's right. And then I went to grad school, got my master's in education policy, came back, ran for the school board, got elected in 2019. COVID hits, and it really just felt like crisis after crisis after crisis that we were navigating. Definitely the hardest professional challenge I've had in my life so far was serving on the school board during the pandemic. I was school board chair in the aftermath of it, but was vice chair in much of the heated moments. We had people, you know, showing up at our school board meetings. Like, there's one time where a guy like stood up and started shouting and walking to us. We had to break the meeting. The school board had to go to like our side room. Law enforcement came in to try to de-escalate. But, you know, just crazy stuff like that was happening on a consistent basis. But also like parents who were deeply fearful of what was happening to their kids, who were angry about what their kids were missing out on, which were all understandable and legitimate concerns and fears. It was a very hard job. I served my full four-year term and ran for the state house in 2022 and got elected then, and I'm coming up on the end of my first term.
I want to talk, let's talk a little bit about that school board experience, mm-hmm. because not only are you new to elective office, you're also young, mm-hmm. you're gay, mm-hmm. at a time when those issues got weaponized mm-hmm. and crazy.
Yep.
Can you talk a little bit about what it was like navigating those dynamics in addition to really hard public policy issues?
When I ran, I knew I would be the youngest and the first openly LGBT person to serve on the school board, but I didn't like campaign on that. Like, that wasn't a focus of why I thought people should vote for me. What was actually most interesting about my campaign was that, coming off of my Oregon Student Association experience at the University of Oregon, I had a campaign team of like 25 or 30 students who organized my entire campaign. Like, they were doing door to door, they were doing digital, they were participating in forums on my behalf. Like, I had a very like youth focused campaign. They helped develop the platform that I ran on, and ultimately that a lot of what we accomplished was part of what we formulated during the campaign.
Oh, wow. That's great.
In terms of like my identities as a young person, I will say like, being unmarried, young, and gay raised suspicions for some of my more conservative constituents. And they made that clear to me in different ways. Like, there was a lot of like dog whistle homophobia experiences that I had that, you know, like, I felt complete support from like my school board colleagues and our superintendent and administrators and the teachers and the vast majority of constituents. So I don't in any way feel like it was a negative experience overall, but for sure that was part of it.
Do you have any advice for someone who's young or LGBTQ, who's like thinking about engaging in public office and wants to engage in public policy, but knows they may have to navigate some of these issues?
Best advice I would have is find a mentor or two or three. I feel very fortunate. I'm still close to, you know, I was talking to Val a week ago. Margaret Doherty lives near me and I talk to her all the time. Governor Kitzhaber is someone who I'm in touch with frequently. And like, I've got people who help me navigate hard things. So that would be number one. And I think, like, I know it's cliche, but you just have to have a thick skin. And this is something I'm not great at, by the way. Like, it still stings sometimes when people are mean to me.
As it should, right? You're a human being.
But you can't let it – this is something that I think I've grown in even in the last few years is, like, you can't let the negative thing, like, impact the quality of your day and be a lasting thing. You kind of have to absorb it and move on or you'll get stuck. You also have to, like, in the legislature, I represent over 70,000 people. If I let one email from one constituent impact my workflow for the day, then I'm probably not representing the other 69,999 folks very well. So you always have to just remember that the people who are most in your face often are not representative of the total population that you represent.
And in my experience, they're often, even though they say they are, they're actually not your constituent usually.
Yeah, that's right.
they sort of like adopting you in order to just make your life hard.
And that totally happened during the pandemic. You had this group of sort of activists who were going district to district to district. And as part of our public comment process, we'd ask people to share their zip code before they start speaking. And you'd hear these folks from outside the district. And I'm like, I don't represent you.
Yeah, exactly. Go bother somebody else.
Yeah.
So you run for the state legislature, mm-hmm. and now you've been selected by your peers to be the majority leader. That's mm-hmm. a wholly different job than just being a legislator. How do you think about this job going forward and especially going into the longer session?
That's a good question. So the way I talk about the job of majority leader is, you know, people when they think of majority leader, I think they think of like national politics. They think of Congress. And the majority leader in Congress is sometimes like the arm twister. They're like driving the agenda. They have like hard power in some cases. Like the Senate majority leader is in charge of the Senate basically. Not so much in Oregon. It's a little bit different. It's not a powerless position. There's definitely power and influence that comes with the role. But I think of it as more of a soft power sort of job. Like it's a relationships job. It's my job to understand the needs of my caucus members and to support them in accomplishing their goals. It's my job to understand the needs and interests of various stakeholder groups and where they're coming at the legislative session, what they need, what they're opposing, and to try to translate all of that on behalf of the caucus. It comes with significantly more work on the campaign side, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
A lot more dollars that need to be raised. I'll be spending a lot of time knocking on doors in swing districts across the state. But yeah, that's how I think of the job. It's like my job to be someone who can work with and bring along my caucus, regardless of if they're the sort of like left side of my caucus or the middle side of my caucus, whether they're young or old or from business or labor. Like it's my job to keep the team together and be the team leader. So I'm excited about the opportunity for sure.
Do you have strategies to do that? I mean, it's that people nowadays tend to like to emphasize their differences,
yeah,
and demonize the other side, often especially within their own party. How do you plan on keeping your team being a team?
I've spent a lot of time thinking about this. My basic thesis is we spend a ton of time working together in the legislature, like a ton of time. You're getting there before 8 and sometimes you're not leaving until 8 p.m. Some people actually live in Salem during the session, right? They drive in and stay there for extended periods of time. But what we don't often do is actually spend time getting to know one another. Like, why are you here? Why did you take on the sacrifice in your life? You know, what was your background? What's your family like? We have our friend groups kind of, but in the broader caucus and certainly in the broader legislature, like there's not very much intentional relationship building. So that's what I want to try to bring to my caucus is helping people understand the why of their colleagues, like what made them want to do this. We've got a very diverse caucus in multiple different ways in the House. And I think giving folks the platform in caucus to share, you know, challenges they've overcome in their life, like things that they're proud of. I just started our caucus. We're starting our caucus meetings now with shout outs. So we're doing 5 minutes at the beginning of the meeting to give shout outs to people in the caucus, something that went well, something they observed for another caucus member. They had a great campaign kickoff or they got great news coverage on a bill of theirs or whatever it may be. Just a way to boost each other and to get a sense of what other people are working on when we're out in our separate worlds.
I like that. And I want to talk about, so you obviously have to manage your own caucus.
Yep.
As you started, you talked about bipartisan. These bills had bipartisan support. You had a podcast with a Republican. Mm-hmm. What kind of relationship do you want to have with the Republican Party in the state?
I want to have a very strong, close working relationship. Our previous speaker, who's now running for Attorney General, a guy named Dan Rayfield, I think did an excellent job of balancing. He basically had a no surprises approach for Democrats and Republicans. Everybody was going to know what we're doing, what we're working on, what we're moving towards. And there's going to be plenty of opportunity to provide their input, whether they love it or hate it or somewhere in between. There was no sense of like, we're not like forcing things through without a process, without input, but we're also not going to let opposition stop us from moving forward with the things that the voters elected us to actually do. So that I hope will be the approach we use moving forward. It's easier to do on a bill like a housing bill, right? Like a housing bill, there's still feelings about it for sure, but it's not the same as abortion. Yeah. It's not the same for other people like LGBTQ rights. So I don't pretend that it's always going to be, we're not going to pass everything on a bipartisan basis because the challenges we face are really difficult and we don't get the option to just opt out of controversial topics. Like we still have to solve problems and legislate. But I do think, again, investing in personal relationships, like during the long session, I was going out to dinner once a week with a group of Republican lawmakers, just building relationships. Regan Knope, my podcast co-host, he works in the Senate, in the Senate Minority Office, and I talk to him every day. So frequent communication, I think, is a tool for building trust, but I also know it's going to be hard sometimes, so I'm not going to pretend that everything's just going to be perfectly bipartisan from now until the end.
If you have the sort of personal relationships and you have the opportunity for people to engage, often that gets you a big part of the way there. Yep. At least it reduces the real anger and resentment that seems to drive so much of national politics.
I think that's right.
So in our last moment here, I think I'd be curious, like, what's your pitch for Oregon? Where do you think it's going to be 10 years from now? Mm. And for folks who are thinking about trying to find a place to live or a place to work or even a place to visit, what do you think Oregon has to offer?
Oregon has a lot to offer. I spent a year traveling the world and the country for a youth education company. Actually, I was doing leadership training and I went to like 30 something states and I went to seven countries. And I told my dad at the end of that, I was like, the more I travel, the more I realize like I just got really lucky being born in this state because it's a beautiful place. Where I live, I'm like an hour from the mountain where there's skiing and snowboarding. I'm like an hour from the coast. I'm like a couple hours from the high desert. And it's green, trees everywhere, the air is clean and easy to breathe. We have some of the best water in the country. So it's a great place. And the thing I love about Oregon too is like it's not a small state. We punch above our weight class for sure, but there still is a sense of community in Oregon and a sense of shared identity in the state. Our political history is what I would like to return to. So I'm a political nerd. 60s and 70s, there's a guy named Tom McCall. Do you remember Tom McCall from your UFO days?
I remember Tom McCall, and I remember his portrait in the in the Capitol where he's ripping the fence off the coastline.
Yes, that's right. So Tom McCall was a Republican governor, but a progressive Republican, something that doesn't really exist anymore. And during his period as governor and his successor, Bob Straub, had a similar viewpoint too. We were a state where we weren't afraid to try new things in our public policy. We weren't afraid to tackle problems that the rest of the state hadn't figured out. So land use planning gets developed under Tom McCall. And land use planning is why we still have thriving farmland and beautiful open spaces that are right next to our cities and housing developments. The public beaches bill, something I think it's my favorite bill in Oregon history. Every stretch of the Oregon coastland is jointly owned by all of us. Private landowners don't get to sort of cordon off sections of the beach that are only for wealthy people. The bottle bill, another Oregon innovation that spread to other states. So we weren't afraid to try new things. We weren't afraid to innovate. And I think that's the direction our politics is getting back to, like having the boldness to solve some of the biggest challenges that we're facing as a country and make sure that Oregon's the best place in the country to live and raise a family. That's the goal.
I love it. And go Ducks.
And go Ducks.
Well, thank you for joining us today. We love having you as part of New Deal. We look forward to watching. And I think you're right. Oregon is the right size and the right mindset to test a lot of initiatives that can be adopted nationally. And we can't wait to see what you do.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me on the pod. This was fun.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service. And because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.